Welcome to our podcast for the course Narco Power and Micro Sovereignty in Mexico. My name is Emily, and in this episode, I am joined by my classmates Colin and Amaya. Together, we speak with anthropologist Adele Velasquez about her book Dawn Rose on a Dead Body, an ethnographic study based on long-term fieldwork in Sinaloa, especially in the municipality she calls Bato. Velasquez examines everyday life in a context shaped by drug trafficking, military presence, and structural inequality, focusing on actors who are often marginalized or rendered invisible in dominant narratives, such as poppy producers, local families, and low-level workers. Rather than reproducing sensationalist images of narco violence, the book shows how violence is embedded in ordinary social relations, economic strategies, and state institutions. And it complicates the idea of a single unified sovereign by highlighting overlapping forms of control by the Mexican state, the armed forces, and criminal networks. In this interview, we put Velasquez's ethnography into dialogue with several theorists from our course, including Thomas Hobbes, Carl von Clausewitz, Akil Membe, and Saik Valencia. We discuss how her work invites us to rethink sovereignty and the so-called state of nature, and how arbitrary killings can still be politically meaningful, how death and precarity are normalized in what Membe calls death worlds, and how drug trafficking economies function as part of contemporary capitalism rather than outside of it. By bringing these theoretical frameworks into contact with Velasquez's detailed ethnographic account, this episode aims to move beyond simplistic representations of narco culture and instead analyze how violence, sovereignty, and survival are historically produced and negotiated in Bato. With that, we invite you to listen to our conversation with Adele Velasquez.
Here we have Adele Velasquez, and overall, I loved your book. I loved reading it and getting the insight and actually having someone do like be down there and doing field research like that is very interesting standpoint, very interesting perspective on how things are. And so my first question is, when you were writing this book, who did you have in mind as your audience? Were you writing for academics, for policymakers, for general readers? Like for Mexicans or like for people like here in the US, and like what did that change at all? Like, did that change at all over the course of writing the book and for doing your research?
Well, the book at the beginning was my PhD thesis in France. So I initially wrote it in French in a very academic setting, but I am following a kind of anthropology that has been very strong in France around the 80s, that consider that our work as an anthropologist is to make available to general reader the familiarity that we built in doing fieldwork. So my supervisor at the time really agreed on that thing with me. So I tried to, I mean, the first way I wrote it, it included a much longer introduction, very more theoretical and methodological and blah, 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 like for the purpose of the PhD, but all the chapters. And then in the way I rewrote the introduction, the idea was to make it very available, very easy to read, like the easier possible. So I think the idea was to think that anybody who could be interested in this kind of issue, the idea was to bet that if somebody is interested in this kind of issue, he can read or she can read my book and has and get to another perspective.
That's really interesting. Another thing is also like shows kind of like Narcos Mexico, and I know there's a ton of other like Netflix and overall like movies shows that kind of like dramatize, like kind of they make the issue like very dramatic, but then it's also been kind of criticized by the DEA for potentially giving like traffickers like operational insights or like other things that may like help them kind of run. So even though like everyone in your book is anonymous, do you ever worry that like being read by the DEA or by like the Mexican military, like how might that like affect like the community, and could it like put them in a vulnerable position?
Yes, at the beginning it was one of my worries, but in first about the way the shows depict this social phenomena, I think one of the issues that they dramatized it, and the other one is that they make it they pretend to make it understandable by following characters. So you have this idea very common in today politics that the people makes one people make something, and that the central characters like Miguel Angel Félix Gallardo, Rafael Caro Quintero, etc. They are the one, the face, and following their trajectory makes it understandable what's happening around the drug trafficking in Sinaloa. And that's a lie in a way, you know. That's I think that is one of the issue. But interestingly enough, during my fieldwork, I got aware very quickly that I was not having information that the DA, the DEA, or the Mexican army did not have. The way have been always stepping aside from the exact organization of the traffic. I mean, I'm not following traffickers. I'm following people who are immersed in this kind of economic setting, and the person that are the closest from illegal activity, and I think that's a whole issue. They are poppy producer. They are not traffickers. They are not. So it, I was not having interesting facts for the military and for the DA, and that got very clear in several situations. One of them was the fact that when the army, the Mexican army, stopped cars in which I was, they never. I mean, it was very clear that they knew who I was, and they didn't care. They didn't care about me because they knew that I usually say, try to say it in a funny way. When I started, when I settled in Badiraguato, I think there was among many people the suspicion that I was a spy. But following what I was doing, I think after 1 month of my presence in the municipal seat, they probably said that, well, if she's a spy, she's a very bad one, so we should not worry about her. And that makes it that's also the case for to understand how why the military didn't care about me. Then I never had an issue when I was crossing the border when I went to the US. I mean, I think what I did was in a setting that is vigilado, there is
Like overwatched.
overwatched. And me inside, they knew what I was doing, and it was not interesting for them because I know what everything I understood. They already know it. They are part, the military forces, the intelligence. They are part of this setting in the way they will repress some and not other. I mean, they are more part of the setting that than exterior actors that would need some information. It's not the case when anthropologists are working, for example, in Mexico, in places where you have a strong political movement. Some of my colleagues, it happened to me that I was crossing the border in an airport with another French colleague that is not working a violence issue, not at all, but the place he works on is a place where you have a strong political movement, and he's the one who got interviewed by the border police. And I was when they saw me, I mean, I went to Los Angeles, I went to Sinaloa, I had to cross the border, and they were like, okay, good day.
Kind of during our class, we took a very like philosophical kind of aspect of like narcoterrorism and drug trafficking. And your book seems to describe a situation where there's a mix of like sovereignty by institution and then also with the cartels having a sovereignty by acquisition and how they're kind of able to like coexist. Do you think Hobbes would recognize what's happening as like a state of nature, basically saying that like a sovereign is being established, or would you argue that like the state of nature is that there is a state of nature because the two sovereigns are kind of fight each other?
Yeah, well, I understand, and I think there are models that are interesting to think, but they are also problematic in many ways. Because in a sense, when I decided to go to Badiraguato without telling it very clearly, one of my questions was, because I've been working in Chihuahua, in the Sierra of Chihuahua before, and I was working in a place where you had two very different groups. From one side, the people called them the Chapos. From the other, they called them the Linea, and you had a village in the battlefront, in a way, you know. So that was a very different situation. And when I went to Badiraguato, my idea was to say, okay, so what's happening, and how do people navigate the uncertainty? Is there violence when you have an established control? And Badiraguato should be the perfect example of one sovereign. And as you can see in the book, it doesn't work like that because we have a tendency to, it's easier to think about institutional model because it talks about what's happening in the upside of a pyramid. So in a way, yes, Badiraguato is controlled by one network that should be able to regulate the violence. However, it depends where you stand, because if you stand with the people who are living there is no regulation of the violence by one network. There are competition. Then the issue of seeing competition as a state of nature, it's like for me, there is a risk of depolitizing the issue when you think about state of nature of Hobbes. It's either a primitive stage that should evolve toward a state. That should evolve, or if you see it today, it's an archaic. It is something primitive that should not exist. While when you try to understand the history of how Badiraguato became this place where indeed you have a facility of using violence to capture many resources, including women. So in a way, yes, that reminds us this kind of state of nature. But it is a historical. It's something that has been historically built, and by the state, by the institution. I mean, the army is over present in Badiraguato. The way the development state of the 60s, the Mexican state of the 60s, is. Thought is very important about how it shaped the economy of Badiraguato. So I think, I think I will go toward the fact that it's always difficult to put one model of sovereignties on a place because you have to move toward a social in different perspective of the same social situation to understand how social relation and violence relation are organized or negotiated, and the other that you have to see the history of a situation. And here there is a very history, there is a very institutional history building a situation where violence is a mean of appropriating resources.
Okay, and then like another philosopher is Clausewitz, and he kind of argues that like the violence is like it's not just like violence against each other. It's not like completely senseless, but it always has a like a political mean, as a like always has a political purpose behind it. And reading your account of like the killing of El Gallito, the municipal police chief, and like his death didn't completely seem random, even though maybe the pop like the community kind of said that like there must have been a reason, kind of like victim blaming him. I wanted to get from your perspective, like, should the violence in Barrio Guato, like, could it be understand as war, since there usually is or possibly is like a political purpose behind it? Or like, do you think it's just something completely different and completely separate to what maybe Clausewitz argues?
I think there is two level of the question. The fact that violence is always political, I think that is what I try to show, including in the case of Badiraguato, because political here should not mean political parties, ideologies, stuff like that, but how society. How people in one social situation will consider what is acceptable, who should rule, who is entitled to have more than the other. Like all that is how a society is organized, and that's a political stance, because even if it doesn't present itself as a built and coherent ideology, it's still his political. In this sense, yes. In the other, actually, I wrote with a colleague in the European Review of Latin American Research. We published an issue with several colleagues from Mexico that was more or less asking that, because we were working with other colleagues that were working in Afghanistan, in Syria, in Iraq, in places where you have a war. And we were talking with them, and we were realizing that the situation in Mexico is quite paradoxical, because on the one hand, you have more deaths in Mexico since 2006 than in Iraq since 2003 or Afghanistan 2001. So it's a situation where you have more violence in a way. Then at the regional level, you can see some of the feature of a war when you have total battle over territorial controls, you have massacres, you have a lot of things that remind you a war. And so you ask why, beyond the fact that this international system, the international organization, usually declare and recognize what is a war and what is not, and that declaration, that recognition has a lot of weight, because it makes the people who are fleeing the violence, they make it refugees, they make it some right. Well, I mean, in the world before today, it's more. It's more complicated than that. But I mean, it's something that has a lot of weight, this international recognition. But on the other hand, there is something that is different in the situation of violence in Mexico than in the situation of Afghanistan, Iraq, etc. And that difference relies a lot on the fact that there is no purpose from the armed group to take control. I mean, they will take control of some places, but even if they take control of some municipality, what they do is extracting its resources. They not build an alternative project. They don't make it a place where things will work differently than than what the Mexican states make. They mold it inside the power structure of the Mexican states. They don't try to overthrow it. They don't try to build an alternative. And so there is more a kind of economy of violence that includes the state and this armed group, and they are embedded in. So I think that is the main difference that you have.
Yeah, absolutely. And so another philosopher that I thought that was really interesting was Membe and his talk about like necropolitics, and he argues kind of about this death world. Like, do you kind of see that Badarguato is a death world in Membe sense? And how do you think about the cartel and the state, like in his terms, as kind of competing sovereigns and like overlapping war machines?
Yeah, I love Bembe. I think it's very inspiring. And of course, I think over many places and situation in the world that can fit with the necropolitics as he proposed it, Badarguato fits. I mean, then I do not work. I mean, even if I do love many of his writing, as you can see, I do not quote, cite it, or build on it because I feel that they are slippery. I mean, you can be yes, but maybe no, because even if you take the sentence that you quote that I made the title of the book, Don Rose on a Dead Body, the way people are over precautious of about how they talk about violence, you can see both things. You can see on the one hand, you can see the euphemize the violence, a tendency to blame the victim, a place where death govern in that sense. But you can see also the other hand, which is the need to protect yourself from violence, and that gives you totally another perspective, a place where people fight for survival, for protecting themselves, their family, to give their children another future. And I think in a political way, you need to see both of those aspects. You need to say that there is a situation of necropolitics that the state is the state and his counterpart with the cartel are building a situation of violence that should be denounced, that should be fight against from your position, from academic position, from a political position. But then you also need to see what people actually do, and it's not they are not rendering themselves available to death. They are not just obeying and making this sovereignty legitimate. They are fighting over it, and that's something that does you cannot describe it by this kind of philosophical political framework. And yet you need to make it visible.
And kind of going along with that, another philosopher we touched was Saik Valencia. She kind of talks about gore capitalism. Do you think the violence in Badarguato fits like this framework? And also, do you think that there's a danger in like academic and journalistic representations of cartel violence and how it could end up participating in that gore economy by kind of desensitizing the killings and overall just the murders that occur?
I think the way I see Badarguato fitting best in her argument is in the way she puts back the violence related with drug trafficking inside the capitalist organization. And that's a very strong and very important point that she makes. And I totally agree with that. And actually, that's part of how I try to make my new research right now, because there is a tendency, a very common tendency in political and elite setting in Mexico, as many other places, to see drug trafficking, narco trafficking, cartels, like something totally else. Like it's the dark side of society. It's the villain that you need to blame so you can say that you are clean in a way. While when I describe something as simple as the relationship of production that you can see in Badiraguato, what I try to put forward in the book is the fact that it is just the most common and modern mechanism of capitalism. It's subcontracting economy. It is the a way for the trafficker to externalize the cost and keep with the plus value. I mean, it's just a capitalist organization. And in this sense, I totally agree with the capitalism argument. Also, there is a book that I don't of Sven Buckert, Sam, he's called, that he's an historian and he retraced the whole the history of how island of capitalism started to connect themselves and expanded and changed the way we all live, we all eat, how we like how we shaped the life of everybody on the planet, because nobody is outside of this economic system. And he shows how violence always has been a feature of this economic system. So that's the way I rely totally with the argument she makes. On the spectacularity of violence, I understand totally what she means, because you had between 2006 and 2017 and still today, but I mean when there was the battle between the CETAS group and the Gulf cartel and the others cartel, I mean there has been some spectacular sense of the body on the bridges that was a very strong and sensationalist and something spectacular to say we control. And that is something that social scientists, we are a bit, we don't know how to take account for that, because it goes some. So I think in that part, yes, there is something about the girl capitalism. You still see it when people are discovering fossils of 500 body buried in some place. Like, so there is this thing.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for your time.
As Colin was saying, we want to thank Adele Blasquez for taking the time to be part of our podcast, and we greatly appreciate the meaningful conversation that was had with her, but also for how her book has contributed to this ongoing conversation. One of the biggest takeaways from this discussion is how her work challenges the simplified ways narco-violence is often represented in popular media and political discourse. Rather than portraying violence as something distant, chaotic, or purely criminal, Blasquez's ethnography shows how it becomes woven into everyday life, social relationships, labor, and survival in Barrio. Throughout this episode, we explored how her work connects to theorists like Hobbes, Clausewitz, Bembe, and Valencia. These conversations push us to think critically about sovereignty, violence, and capitalism, not as abstract concepts, but as lived realities that shape people's daily experiences. We discuss how state power and cartel power often overlap rather than exist as completely separate forces, and how violence can become normalized in spaces where insecurity, poverty, and militarization are constant. Other important reflections from this interview is the ethical responsibility involved in studying and representing violence. Blasquez reminds us that behind statistics, headlines, and dramatized portrayals are real communities navigating difficult and complex conditions. Her work pushes us to move beyond stereotypes of narco culture and instead pay attention to the humanity, agency, and vulnerability of the people living within these systems. Ultimately, this conversation shows that understanding narco politics in Mexico requires more than focusing only on crime or warfare. It requires examining the historical inequalities, economic systems, and forms of power that made these realities possible in the first place. Thank you for listening to our podcast. We hope this discussion encourages you to think more critically about violence, sovereignty, and representation, both within Mexico and beyond.